Welcome to the summer school course. I'm Janet Small from the Centre for Open Learning. Please check your cell phones or switch off before we begin. Food security may conjure up ideas of farms, tractors and rural land issues, but for major cities around the world, urban food security and Passover supply are critical questions. And we're very pleased to have our colleagues from UCT's African Centre for Cities here at summer school again this year to present their research and knowledge on this topic. So I'm going to ask Professor Gordon Pirie to introduce the course today, which is entitled, What Does It Take to Feed a City? Understanding the Urban Food System. Professor Pirie, who is a respected geographer in his own right, is here, the Deputy Director of the African Centre for Cities, and introduce the course and the speaker for this evening. Thanks, Dr. Pirie.
Professor.
That's sweet of you, thank you. I'm not so sure I'm going to introduce the courses as much as I firstly want to.
You have to use the mic.
I'm going to shout.
Use the mic.
Where is the microphone? This is so distant from you, but anyway. I wanted to welcome you here and to say how nice it is to see such a big turnout for an event like this, which tells us something about the topic, I suspect, but also the speaker, of course. And I hope also that it tells me something about the importance, even in this internet, iPod, everything else age, the importance of eye-to-eye contact, face-to-face contact, but also, I suspect, the pleasure and the stimulation of coming to a physical place with which you have associations, long-standing associations, and which in its own right is inspiring. I'm not too sure the concrete and all is inspiring as wood-paneled rooms might be, but I'm sure there's something for you all about being in a university, coming and making contact with intellectual ideas that in its own right is very worthwhile. I want to introduce the speaker this afternoon. Jane Battersby, standing over there in her bright shirt. Jane attended school in Oxford and a whole succession of universities in the UK, where she did a BSc honours degree at King's College in London, and then moved on to a master's degree in, would you believe it, international cultural change at Newcastle, before ending the paper chase at Oxford, where she wrote her PhD in geography. And then UCT was very lucky to be able to harness Jane in 2000 or thereabouts, and to have her on a postdoc and doing quite a lot of teaching and supervision and coordination of geography courses at UCT in the interim. Jane styles herself as an urban, social and cultural geographer with a particular fascination in food security and food systems, key points that we'll be tracking in the next three lectures. She works in our African Centre for Cities, one of the remarkable and indeed lovely people affiliated with us. She's the Cape Town partner of the African Food Security Urban Network, AFSUN Network, and leads the program in urban food security at UCT. She's also a researcher in an African-Swedish project set up to scrutinize ways of knowing in urban ecology. The basic idea here, if I may be so pertinent to say so, is crudely that things are not always as they seem to be. This is a particular academic take on the world and one that crosses over very nicely into the question of eating, nourishment, and food access in cities. Things are not always as they appear to be. Jane's research repertoire has stretched from the post-apartheid city, hip-hop there, education and racial identity, and land restitution. She brings this breadth to bear on food security and its relation to spatial, geographical, and social transformation. There is every reason indeed not to let dietitians and retailers have a monopoly on food. Jane's key interests are urban design for food security, food justice, the connections between formal and informal retailing sectors as regards food, in children's food geographies, and in the link between food and social identity. We are what we eat. And as Jane always reminds us, her work goes beyond advocating a food garden on every city plot. She has published and refereed academic papers in the way that all of us do, and has attended scholarly conferences and examined postgraduate students. But she also reaches out to and has an influence in broader civil society, partly via her blog, which she has called Food Ramblings, not Food Rumblings, note, and has been an active contributor to the Daily Press and in radio and television. Some of you may have seen or heard her last week in the media talking on subjects of hunger and food waste. Some of you may indeed even have spotted her running around Cape Town's various road races. She spoke at summer school last year, and we only had one single lecture then, hosted by the ACC on food systems, but it was such a success that we've decided this year to give the topic a bit more air. Jane will give two lectures. Tomorrow's presentation is by our colleague sitting over there, Gareth Hayson. Both have absolutely wonderful research material to share with you. For now, please welcome Jane.
Gosh, after that introduction, I'm a little intimidated by myself. So sit back and hope we enjoy this. So this is the first of three on what does it take to feed a city? As Gordon said, I'll be doing two. I'll be doing this first one and the third one, and Gareth will be doing the one in the middle. And essentially, it's questions of, well, why talk about food and why talk about cities? Of all the things we could be engaging with at summer school, why focus on those things? And so tonight, I'll be introducing that theme and then using an area in the city called the Philippi Horticultural Area as a way to try and unpack some of these challenges around food in the city. Tomorrow, Gareth will be mainly talking around the sustainability challenge and what sustainability and food and cities mean when they come together. Is the microphone working at the back? Okay, great. And if I start speaking too fast, please also let me know. I tend to ramble. I only have one coffee today, so hopefully things are going to be slow enough. And then in the final session, we'll try and pull it together and look at what some of the policy responses might be. If this is one of the largest challenges facing our cities, as I believe it is, what should be the policy response? What should be the NGO response? How do we as citizens respond to that? So just to carry on with the introductions, just to give you a context of where we're working out of, the African Food Security Urban Network, or AFSUN, is a partnership of 11 cities in 9 southern African countries. So we're not just Cape Town, we're across the region. And we've got a research, a policy, and a capacity development mandate. And our research really is around three key questions. The first is this: how is it that poor people in cities access food? And when we started the research in 2008, it became very apparent that most people weren't accessing food. So what are the challenges in place? As a result of that, then is there something around the way in which our cities are being designed and managed that either helps or hinders access to food? We often think about food insecurity and hunger as being this kind of household experience, but what happens if it's more of a systemic problem? What if it's a structural problem around the food system and the urban system? And then the final question is, well, what is the policy response out of that? And so that's where we're trying to work to now. This is just a map of where we're operating. So you can see all the way up to Zambia, three cities in southern Africa. And all of our work is available for download at our website, www.axon.org. As part of the ACC, we have this slightly more touchy-feely approach, a rigorous academic approach, but also a more nuanced and more culturally engaged approach. So the mission of the ACC is to conduct collaborative research, so recognizing that the universities themselves do not have their answers on their own. It's around collaboration with other academic institutions, but also with the NGO sector, with the government sector, with the creative sectors. And to contribute to imaginative policy discourses and practices to promote vibrant, just, and sustainable cities. So we're trying to think a little bit more outside the box, beyond those obvious answers that people come up with, because clearly when you look at the world today, the obvious answers haven't been all that obvious. And so the ACC works with the African scale, the Global South scale, city scale, Southern African scale, and all the way down at UCT. So that's our way of introduction. So why ask what it takes to feed cities? As I said, it's not the most obvious question you could come up with. So why are we asking this? Firstly, we are living in an increasingly urban world. As of 2008, more than half the world's population lived in cities. So I just want to take you through a graphic showing the rates of urbanization from 1950 to projected to 2050. Each dot represents a country. The size of the dot represents the size of the urban population in that country. The color of the dots, purple means that more than 75% of the population live in urban areas. Yellow is 50 to 75%. Blue is 25 to 50%. And green is less than 25%. So if you look at the world in 1950, it's only really Western Europe that's got very high urbanization rates. The US, Europe. Places like India, although they have sizable urban populations, had less than 25% of their national population living in cities. And the urban situation in Africa is more or less absent. So let's just follow this through from 1950 to 2050 and look at the trend. Let's try that again. Quite a different world we're looking at. See if I can make that work one more time. Technology always works when there's nobody watching. So in 100 years, we're going to see a dramatically different world, a profoundly, predominantly urban world, and areas of the world that have been rural forever are suddenly overtaking those that have had a longer history. So in the 20th century, the world's urban population increased from 220 million to 2.84 billion, which is a staggering figure. But then when you look in the next 40 years, in the first 40 years of the 21st century, we're going to see that increase again. That has profound impacts on economies, on resource use, on the way we live. 93% of that new growth is going to be in developing world countries. We're not going to see a similar experience of urbanization. It's going to be a very different experience of urbanization. We all think of kind of this burgeoning megacity, the Lagoses of the world, these massive 10 million people cities. But actually the reality is in Africa, more than 51% of African urbanites will be living in cities of less than 500,000. So there might not be the same kind of ecological crisis, but the governance structures may not be in place. So there's a real need to understand this shift. We're also seeing the urbanization of poverty. It's not simply that poor people move from rural areas to urban areas. There's also something going on within urban areas. Many people become poorer when they reach cities. Materially, physically, in terms of health, all of these things come through. There's this idea of the healthy migrant. Often people come to the city healthy, and within five years, their health profile is much decreased. Incidences of diseases like TB, cholera, all those things to do with being in a dense, unplanned urban environment. But also increasingly diseases like hypertension, diabetes are all part of the urban condition. So there's this change of experience. So why focus on food? We can see this massive change. Of all the things we could think about, we could think about land, we could think about housing. Why think about food? Well, firstly, food insecurity is a critical health and development challenge. We know that if a child is malnourished, their intellectual development will be impaired, their physical development will be impaired. So it's a human tragedy. But beyond that, it also has then impacts on the economic development of the city. If your workforce is not as physically or mentally developed, then you're going to have challenges. As I said before, within urban areas, we see an increase in diabetes, hypertension, obesity. These are all part of the urban condition. So it's a critical development challenge. We're also seeing that the urban diet is quite different to the rural diet, and that has these ecological, economic, and political implications. If you think about somewhere like West Africa, the diet used to predominantly be sorghum-based. As people move to the cities, people's diets change. People demand more, we term, sort of modern foods, but also the time economy that people have, the the cost and time of making something like sorghum is much harder than growing rice, eating rice. And so we're seeing a fundamental shift. So in places like West Africa, the urban markets have become flooded with cheap imports of rice, second quality rice from Indonesia. Sorghum has become less popular, and it's having this impact on the relationship between rural and urban areas. It's having an impact on health. It's having an impact on the global trade situation. So this kind of changing urban diet has these knock-on effects, both within the countries, but also beyond. And then finally, if we just look at an individual city, the ecological footprint of our food is massive. We tend not to think about it, but in work that Barry Gasson did on Cape Town, he found something like 41% of Cape Town's ecological footprint could be accounted for by food. And so if we're thinking about planning for our cities, we need to think about planning for food. We're seeing this changing global geopolitics of food. As the urban diet requires more food, as more people move to the cities, oftentimes countries themselves can't meet that need. And so we're seeing this process of land grabbing, particularly in places like Saudi Arabia that are fast running out of land and fast running out of water, are buying up land across the world. And so we're seeing a real change in I suppose, global geography as a result of some of the food challenges. And these things aren't happening in isolation. We're looking at a context of climate change. And so this map shows the projected changes to agricultural productivity by 2080 due to climate change. And in vast swathes of Africa, the dark red show up to a 50% reduction in productivity as a result of climate change. Think back to where those areas of massive urban growth are, where there's massive demand for food, and we see there's potentially quite a large problem on our horizon. Is everybody thoroughly depressed yet? It will get better, I promise. But before it gets better, it may get a little bit worse, because we are seeing these periods of hyper food inflation, these periods of an economic crisis where food price spikes go up. So in 2008, we had a massive food price spike. 2011, 2012, we had the same thing. And it's this concatenation of these multiple stresses. So it's about weather events, declining global food stocks, trade policies, global consumption increases, economic growth, something as simple as the dollar devaluation and the impact that has on food prices, the ways in which people sort of trade on the currency markets, the way in which food is traded as a commodity rather than as a foodstuff. All of those things come together to create these food shocks. And there are increasingly concerns around whether we're going to see food riots. There's been some work done that has tried to map periods of civil protest and tallying it with food price increases. And globally, there does seem to be something in it. Just in the last few months, the same team have done a mapping of South Africa. And it may just be coincidence, but there does seem to be the period of xenophobic violence that we had in 2008 and the recent labor protests that we see now do tend to track with increases in food price. Now, I'm not saying that food prices are driving all the problems we're seeing, but I think we might need to recognize that it is an element that we need to be considering. If you think back to some of the things you've seen on the news in the last few weeks, when people are talking about their experience of poverty, when the farm workers were striking, what was the language they were using? It was a language of not being able to afford to buy food. So there's something tangible about food price and the experience of poverty and the experience of hunger and what that might trigger. So these are some things we have real concerns about. But I also see food as this incredibly hopeful thing. Because when we start looking at the food system, it starts to help us connect these disparate things. It starts to help us connect some of the challenges around housing, the challenges around land use, understanding some of the ecological challenges we're facing. It enables us to pull those things together. So Carolyn Steele, in her brilliant book, Hungry City, says to see the world through food is to see it with lateral vision, to understand how apparently disparate phenomena are in fact connected. So I think maybe when you're out of summer school, just drive around the city and look at food and think how food connects so many of our daily experiences. I started doing that, and it's been a revelation. So let's try and ground this and see how it ties in practically to what we're living in the city of Cape Town. And so for the rest of this session. We'll be looking at seeing the food system through the Philippic horticultural area, which is currently a largish horticultural area within Cape Town. Have many people been to the PHA? Okay, good. Because oftentimes when I talk, most people have never even heard of the place. So it's hopefully by the end of the day, those of you who haven't been will know the space and have a feel for it. So, within our AFSUN work in 2008, we rolled out a survey looking at people's access to food. We worked in Ocean View, we worked in Philippi, and we worked in Khayelitsha. And the aim was to try and understand how people access food, what their challenges were, what their experiences were. And in Cape Town and across our 11-city region, we found deep food insecurity. In Cape Town, we found up to 80% food insecure. And I can talk about what that means after the session, but I'd rather not get into that now. But we found these very high levels of food insecurity in Cape Town and across our 11 cities. And so there's a real challenge about what do we do about that. The problem is, if we just focus on food insecure households, then I think we miss quite a lot of the big picture. We miss what the challenges really are. So if we focus only on households that experience food insecurity, then the kinds of strategies we put in place to solve it are all around targeting households, around poverty alleviation, and not really recognizing that food challenge is more of a systemic problem. It's not just the household experience. The household experience is shaped by these global processes, these spatial planning processes, these environmental agendas. All of these things come together to shape food insecurity. And so if we miss the systemic nature of the problem, then the solutions we're going to come up with are going to be like putting band-aids on. They're not really going to address what the real challenge is. And so I think if we use the Philippine horticultural area as a way of looking at the food system, we might be able to understand some more of what's going on. So within our work, when we talk about food security, we understand food security as being this first half around the adequate daily supply of food that's affordable, nutritious, hygienic, and culturally appropriate. And that's where most definitions stop. So it's about getting people enough of the right kinds of foods. What we're saying is, that's fine, but until you see it as part of this much broader system involving the reliable and sustainable production, procurement, distribution, and consumption of goods, you're not going to address the problem. And so this is why we're saying, take a broader look, step back, and look at the food system as a whole, and use this Philippi area as one way to try and unpack some of that. So the Philippi horticultural area, cultural area is this large patch of green. It's been farmed for well over 100 years. It's located now in the middle of the city when it was established at the periphery of the city. And it's been slowly eroded by urban development. It's estimated that probably only about 10% of the original extent of the land still exists. There's been a recent change to the rural zoning. And a bite has recently been taken out of it. The land has been bought by developers, it's been rezoned from rural to urban, is open to development. It's been quite a controversial process, and that's not what I want to talk about tonight. I think we can maybe get into that in questions, but that's not the focus of what we're talking about tonight. Tonight we're using the existing areas to try and understand some of the dynamics of the food system. So the Philippi horticultural area. At the moment it's producing, Gareth and I did some research there last year, about 91,000 tonnes of fresh produce per year. Trying to get a handle on that, it's estimated that still about 40 to 50% of Cape Town's cauliflower, carrots and lettuce come from the PHA. So it's quite a small area, but it's still incredibly productive. The main produce is cabbage, lettuces, cauliflower, spinach, carrots, potatoes, onions, but also things like coriander, kale, a number of other products. The area is being encroached. There is pressure on the land for housing. We have a housing shortfall in Cape Town of about 400,000 houses. This is a large open area. You can see why the connection is made. But I want to tell the story of the PHA through four farmers. I think it can be quite easy to get sort of tied up in dry facts. So I'm going to tell four stories about four farmers to try and unpack what's going on. I don't want to run over time, so I can get carried away because these farmers are fascinating people. So the first one is a farmer called Johan. Johan is a commercial farmer. He's been, and his family have been on the farm for a number of generations. Now there's this notion that the area is becoming less and less productive and people are moving out. Johan is a kind of counter to that story because Johan has 150 hectares and Johan has slowly been acquiring land. Some farmers have sold up and moved on because it's been financially struggling, difficult for them. Johan has been buying up. So in 1999 he bought 25 hectares, 2000 he bought 16, and then another 10 and a half, and then another 16, 30 hectares in 2011, 18 hectares in 2005. And so he's been buying up and consolidating. You can see land is at a premium. They don't have fences, they farm all the way up to the road because you've got to use whatever land you have. Not having fences leaves you open to a little bit of what they call night harvesting, but it's a hit you take. So Johan's been farming, Johan's been buying up. Now, Johan has changed his farming practices over the last few years. Traditionally, the farmers would sell to what used to be Epping Market, is now the Cape Town Fresh Produce Market. He now more or less exclusively sells directly to the supermarkets. About 70 to 85% of the Philippi fresh produce now goes directly to the supermarkets. And this has been a real change. And what's happened is, as the supermarkets have become more important in the country, they've been able to come to the farmers with contracts and guarantee that they will buy whatever the farmer produces at a set price. So now the farmer has some security and he knows that he'll be able to sell, but he can't necessarily go around to the Epping Market to try and find the best price he can. It's a deal that you make a trade on. Do you have a guaranteed sale and take the price you're given, or do you shop around and then you miss out on the sale? So Johan, like most of the farmers, have gone for this option. They also prefer selling direct to the supermarkets because now they can control the cold chain. So he produces his food, harvests it, takes it to his own pack shed, does his own processing, gets the transport system, goes straight to the supermarket. The cold chain is unbroken, the quality of the food is guaranteed. If it goes to Epping, then the cold chain might be broken, the quality of the produce is less good, you get a not such a good price. So there's these kind of things that people are making decisions on. So there's this change happening, there's this consolidation, there's this shift to the supermarket sector. Johan employs quite a lot of labour. We think in the PHA as a whole, there's about 2,500 full-time workers, and about 1,400 were taken on during high season. As you can see, it's very labour-intensive farming. The farm plots are quite small, so you can't do the kind of industrial agriculture that you see out in the rural hinterlands. 70% of the labour are female, mainly from local areas. The farmers estimate they give about 3 kilograms of food per day to each worker. So there's quite a considerable food flow going out of the area, not just through the supermarkets, but through the workers themselves. If you look at the farming practice, there's something interesting going on as well. Each of these rows is a different age. Instead of planting once throughout the season, the farmers plant piecemeal. So they can continually harvest, continually have stuff go to the market, and continually be employing. So there's something interesting around the dynamics of how people work. Now, I said 70 to 85% of the produce goes straight into the supermarket sector. Some goes to the workers. The rest ends up in this informal sector. And when we did the work in Cape Town, we asked people where they got their food from. And the lower income households predominantly got their food from this informal market, from the street traders. And the produce from the PHA that doesn't go to the supermarket sector goes straight into there. And we think this is a profoundly important system to understand, and one that's not really been engaged with enough. Because if this is where the lowest income people are accessing their food from, then surely we need to understand it a little bit better. Last year I had a student mapping all the supermarkets in Cape Town. The darker areas on the maps are, well, you're from Cape Town, you can see it. The darker areas are the highest income areas, the lightest areas, the low income areas. Category one here are the lowest quintile by income areas in Cape Town. So if you take all the areas of Cape Town according to the 2001 census and map them out, the lowest fifth are category 1, the highest fifth are category 5. If you look at the number of supermarkets per 1,000 households across those different types of areas, you'll see the supermarkets are much more centered in wealthy areas. This is not a surprise. We know that supermarkets are going to locate where the wealth is because they need to make profit. But what about those areas that are underrepresented? Where are those people getting their food from? When we looked then at the USAVE brand, which is ShopRite Checkers' sort of budget brand, which specifically says they target low-income areas, even they are missing category 1. And so those people are profoundly dependent on this informal trade sector. And so we think it's really important that there is this chain from the Philippine horticultural area out into these areas. In fact, when we've spoken to the informal traders, they will say they preferentially seek Philippine horticultural area produce because they know that it's come off fresh. They also know that it's complied to the same regulations that's gone into the supermarket sector food. So there seems to be an element that this is an important thing. So what can we learn from Johan? I realize our time is moving on. First thing we can see from Johan is this pattern of farm consolidation, that a number of farmers have gone out of business. We think there's about half as many farmers in Philippines now as there were in 1994. But there's more land under production. The less economically viable farmers are selling up, the more economically viable farmers are buying up and getting pulled into the supermarket system. Now, 50% decline in Philippines sounds terrible, but people like Nick Funk and Van Rooyen, Stats SA, etc., have all found nationally we've declined about 75% in terms of the numbers of farmers. So nationally, we're seeing this massive consolidation of the farming sector. One of the largest supermarkets, I can't say which one because it was said in a private context, and I might have to do some unmentionable things if I declare which supermarket it was. One of the larger retailers recently said that they procure about 80% of their fresh produce from 10 large agribusinesses. So we're seeing a real shift in the ways in which our farm system operates. We're seeing this increased supermarket control, and we're not entirely sure what that's going to mean for the lowest income households. We're seeing changing farming practices, with farmers increasingly operating as wholesalers, increasingly doing some on-site processing. So a real shift in how the system's operating. And we are seeing that there's this integration between the formal and the informal food retail sectors that are often seen as being quite separate things. So from Johan, we can start to see some of the tensions in the food system. I want to introduce you next to Kiam. I haven't asked to use his picture, so I've had to blank his face out. But Kiam is an emerging farmer, although sometimes he'll say he's a submerging farmer. Kiam got a piece of land, 26 hectare piece of land, as a land reform recipient about 5 years ago. In fact, his farm is one of the farms that Johan used to own and sold up because it wasn't as viable as some of the other ones that he had. So Kiam's got this piece of land. He struggles to find markets. He struggles with theft. He thinks over the last 2 years he's lost about 200,000 rand worth of irrigation equipment from theft. This is the challenge of being a farming area in a city. He struggles to find markets. He says about 30% of the budget that he was meant to get from land reform was meant to go to farmer support, but he's still waiting for a tractor. He still has to borrow a tractor from Johan when he wants to do his work. He can't access markets easily. He says he wants to sell into the supermarkets, and he knows that the supermarkets need him because supermarkets have got only about 1% of their produce coming from black farmers. He says, you know, the supermarkets need him, but he can't get into that market. The only way he can sell his produce to the supermarket is to go through Johan. So he takes his price from Johan, who then takes his price from the supermarkets. So he's struggling to find his role in this system. I asked him whether he didn't want to sell rather to the Cape Town fresh produce market. And he said the quality of his goods is too good to stay into there. He'd much rather sell it to this formal sector. I said, well, maybe he sells to the informal traders. He said he's producing too much to sell there. So how does he find access to a market? The government would like us to move to having small-scale farmers as the bastions of food security, but there seems to be this continued dependence on the large-scale farmer as a means to stay financially viable. He's also got these problems of theft and labour challenges. He inherited a farm with 16 farm workers who he can't employ, but they live on site, so he has to pay the electricity and water. In the recent farm labour protests, I think there were concerns that those least able to pay the increased minimum wage were the black farmers. And so all these things start to play out. And some of those massive debates that we've been hearing in society are all playing out down here in this little Philippine horticultural area. On a more positive note, the story about Ali. Now, Ali has a vision. He wants to be a local farmer. He wants to sell to a local market, buying into those ideals around local production, those things that we hear about. He wants to be organic, and he has a holistic vision about his farm. Ali's farm, it took him 22 years to get it. He's wanted to be a farmer ever since before his family was moved under Group Areas Act when they had some chickens in the yard. He's fostered this vision. Ali owns about 2 hectares in the Scarcroll smallholder farming area. Now, Ali's farm is a wondrous place because he's got everything growing there. And he's trying to farm organically. He's trying to do a number of things that will help his farm. So he realized that his land was getting flooded every year, so he used his own money to buy 67 trucks of sand that he's used to raise the level of his farm. He said he could be waiting for the Department of Agriculture to fund him, but he's not a young man anymore. So he's gone in alone. And he's producing largely organically, and he's trying to produce holistically. So he has his plots of veggies, he's got onions and chilies to try and prevent the pests from moving in. He's got chickens. He's got some rabbits that he feeds with the offcuts from the vegetables. He uses the fertilizer to fertilize his veggies. And ideally, he would eat his rabbits, but he can't quite bring himself to do that. Now, Ali initially wanted to sell into the organic market. The problem is he's not certified. And certification costs are too high. So he now has a deal with some local restaurants where they will believe that he's producing organically. They don't require him to have the certification, and he's therefore able to sell. But it's a limitation. He also wants to farm full-time, but at the moment he can't quite afford it. So on his plot, he's doing a number of things that fall slightly outside of the city's regulations of what you're allowed to do on the land. So he's farming, but he's also got a brood wall kennel and a boat building business. And this is one of the challenges. How do you get an emerging farmer viable? Because Kian's model clearly isn't working. Depending on the state to provide isn't working. Getting tied into the commercial farmer who's a price taker who then offers you a poor price isn't working. Ali is then struggling because he's trying to go it alone, but he's falling foul of the regulations. And a lot of people are in this situation. So this is from the Scarcroll area. And there's a number of practices that don't necessarily fit with what's meant to happen in the area. So how do you reconcile what the legislation is with what the reality is, and try and keep these people viable? And we talk about local and organic as if they're kind of a middle-class conceit. What we found, this is a picture from Joburg, I couldn't find a nice picture of Cape Town, there's something really interesting going on in the Philippine horticultural area. One of the commercial farmers was approached by a group of Zimbabwean traders a few months ago, and they're saying, we cannot find the foods that we want to eat in Cape Town. We cannot find the mustards, we cannot find the kale, we can't find the cobo. Please put a section of your field aside and grow the foods that we are used to growing in Zimbabwe. And so they started to do that. So this kind of notion of a local food that you can trace is transcending just the middle class white problem. It's coming all the way through the system. And so from Ali, what do we learn? We learn there's a need for a responsive food system, a food system that can respond to the needs and desires of people in the system. There's concerns about traceability. Just last year when we were doing the research in Philippi, there was the uproar around the halal meat that ended up containing pig. Kind of awkward. And yet only last week in the UK there was the same crisis around horse meat in economy burgers. And so there is this concern, well, how do we have a traceable system where there's this great consolidation where you don't know where things are coming from? Perhaps this kind of local engagement is important. But how then do you do this with certification? How do you do this in a context where people aren't necessarily compliant? And is the smallholder farmer really going to be a source of food security? Because Ali's not trying to go into the food secure solving that problem, he's trying to survive. So that all these things start to come through. And then a final farmer is Mazia, who's an activist farmer. In fact, more of an activist than a farmer these days. Mazia is also a smallholder in the Scarcroll area, and he's a shop owner. But through his attempts to get going as a farmer, he's become quite an activist. He's realized a lot of the challenges. In fact, his first year of farming, he was growing tomatoes. And he harvested tomatoes and realized he didn't have a market. So he was driving around all over Cape Town with this bucket of tomatoes, trying to find a market and trying to, and realizing that there's all these challenges for the smallholder farmer. But as he's got going, he's become aware of some of the challenges around sort of genetically modified foods, concerned around the ecological challenges of large scale commercial farming, certainly concerned around land use. I'm concerned about how separated we've become from our food system. So he and Ali often bring children from Hanover Park, from Lavender Hill, into the Philippi Horticultural Area. Now, according to some of the maps that have been produced by some of the city, the area has low aesthetic qualities. And yet, if you're coming from an area where you never get to go into green space, it has incredibly high aesthetic qualities. And so there's something going on about using food as a way to re-engage people with, for want of a better word, nature. So Nazir has now set up this PHA for Food and Farming campaign. He's very connected to the Princess Play Anti-Development Forum as well. So there's this kind of ground-up activism. And Nazir's been trying to push an alternative to what the city's mapping of the PHA is. So within the city, there's that piece of land in the southeast corner that's been eaten out. It was a piece of sand mining land bought up by a developer, now proposed to put housing on it. Nazir is proposing to the city that they put a block on that and is proposing an alternative. And I'm not going to comment on the viability of the alternative, I'm just going to explain what his alternative is. And his argument is that we need to keep this as a food production area. The area is too valuable to lose. We need to keep commercial agriculture viable, so that uncoloured section in the middle is commercial agriculture. And he's proposing all around the outside a series of 1 acre plots, which smallholders would be able to live on, and that would serve as a buffer to try and prevent some of the challenges of the urban coming in. His model's also informed by his understanding of the land itself. He says, you know, if you live in the area, you know that this area, which is being given over, has the highest agricultural potential and the area at the top has the lowest agricultural potential. So recognizing that the city does need housing, but suggesting they put it somewhere else. So, again, it's another kind of engagement, another kind of expression of what the food system is and how we plan for food in the city. So, I'm going to wrap it up with those four stories. This is a picture taken from the southeast corner of the Philippi Horticultural Area. This is one of the sand mining trucks coming in. This is the area that's been proposed for development. And it's just that juxtaposition of the pressure for development, the pressure for housing, meeting this productive landscape. And I don't pretend to have any of the answers. I don't pretend to be unbiased in the politics of it, but I think it's a really useful way to try and unpack some of these challenges in the food system and start to think about food security as being beyond just helping the poor and the hungry and understanding that the food system is in fact impacting all of us and the processes that are happening in the city are affected at the wider national and global scale. And sometimes the food question isn't really about food at all. So tomorrow I'm going to hand over to Gareth to pick up on some of the sustainability thing, and then on Wednesday we'll come back and talk about policy.
food topic. I think I mentioned last year that in all the subjects that I've studied, nothing has caught my eye as the food topic has, in the sense of the novelty that it presents us and the new ways it presents us with looking and understanding our reality. And what's so extraordinary about it is that we just take it for granted, so many of us. You know, it's Morse food. But as Jane has shown us, it's infinitely more complicated and layered and complex and nuanced, and a wonderful topic to get one's teeth into. What I love about it also is the sense that food is about material things, but it's also about looking at things differently. It's a, as Jane puts it, it's a lens, a different lens for looking at our world, looking at things, looking at interrelationships through the food perspective. Let's take a round of questions. So if you'll just put your hands in the air and I'll recognize them. Let's do four. One, two, three, four. You first, sir.
There's a lot of argument going on about patriarchal societies. But one of the things that comes across, if you look at the food side of life, the production tends to be very much male-dominated, not so much the distribution and certainly not the consumption. Do you see this as a social factor worth thinking about or not?
Yes.
I've spent about the last 20 years looking at the next thing down the thing, namely how people can cook. And it's very fascinating seeing changes in diet that are taking place in the informal side of things. And in particular, looking, for instance, in the Khayelitsha area, the way in which the poor, the very poorest, having struggles because they can't preserve food. Because one of the first things that happened when you've got electricity, well, the very first is getting light. The second thing is getting refrigeration. And it's been very interesting actually unpacking that and seeing how, what a difference it makes to people's lives to actually acquire refrigeration.
In the four stories that you spoke about in the same area, do they live, do they exist in conflict with each other because they have such different ideas, or are they all coexisting in an area and fighting their own fight and not trying to do this and sell what they have?
Jane, do you want to?
Thank you. I'm just very interested to what extent this Philippi area is unique for cities. Do other cities have this remarkable phenomenon that right almost in the middle of the city there's this large agricultural area where it's growing up to 40% of certain products? That's number one. Number two, following from that, is what proportion of the sort of total food needs of the city of Cape Town is being supplied by Philippi? Because that leads on to the question of its real viability in the end, whether it's not going to be overtaken by these big agribusinesses in the end, and we'll see tall rise flats going up there in the end.
Great. Well, thank you for quite a range of questions. So I'll take them in the order they were asked. The gender reproduction is an interesting one, because more or less all the farm workers in Philippi are female and all the farmers are male. And it is a long-standing long-standing trend, and I think actually increasingly farm labour is becoming more female, certainly in this area, in the less heavily mechanised. Quite what it all means, I'm not entirely sure. I think that there's a lot more pressure around general transformation of the agricultural sector. I think gender has been somewhat left off the agenda. There are certainly some people in livestock production who are women, but the actual agricultural, horticultural production tends to be male-dominated. It's very often a very much a family affair, so when we try and get hold of some of the farmers, we end up speaking more to their wives than to the farmers. And the cooking and food preservation thing, absolutely. One of the things that we've been tentatively trying to get some money off the ground is around food storage, because one of the reasons we see such poor diets in urban areas is because of precisely this problem of food storage. So the time you have to cook in the evenings is limited by the huge distances people travel to and from work. You know, if you're traveling an hour and a half each way to work, the kinds of food options you're going to have are more limited. But certainly if you don't have good preservation, good storage, you can't keep fresh produce. You certainly can't do fresh meat. And so we've been trying to think about, well, what might some of the low-tech solutions be be to this, and if you have any suggestions, we'd be very keen to hear that. And whether they're in conflict or coexisting, it's interesting because in some ways you'd expect some of the emerging farmers to be in conflict with the commercial farmers, particularly in the case of Kiam and Yohan, where they're so dependent. But they recognise that without those farmers, there wouldn't be the mentoring. They recognise that without the knowledge that's there, there wouldn't be some of those processes in place. There's more tensions between the different sectors of the emerging farm. There's only about 10 of them, but they all have quite different ideas about how the place should be run. And so Nazir, the activist, is more happy to engage with the commercial farmer than some of the others. And this is why, in his vision, he has the commercial farmers in there and almost seeing the emerging farmers as playing a protecting, buffering role for them. So there's quite a big story. And even the commercial farmers themselves are not all in agreement. So there's some who have been trying to encourage the city to allow their land to be rezoned for urban so they can get development money out of that. And there's others who are desperate to stay on the land. So within each group there's tensions. I think as in every group. And then finally, to what extent is this unique? I haven't found another city that's got a horticultural area like this within it. But most cities do have a horticultural band outside of them. And I know the city of Joburg has identified where all their productive, potentially productive and productive land is, and are trying to put in measures to protect it. But we know that the reality of urban development is that it's hard to make that argument when it seems so obvious that food can come from everywhere. But
At a price.
And I mean, the concern we've got around the loss of this is, again, as transport prices go up, as climate change happens. One of the strange things about Philippi is one of the reasons it was established as a farming area is because it's got a very particular microclimate. So it's protected from the worst of the summer heat. It's got an aquifer, so it doesn't need extensive rainfall. And so in some ways it's more climate resilient than some of the other areas that we get our food from. And so one of the arguments for protecting it is precisely that it has this microclimate, that its unique characteristics are the things that make it viable, if a little idiosyncratic.
Take another round. One from there.
First.
One from there.
I want to look at that picture. Not a single tree is a fruit tree. And Cape Town University hasn't got one fruit tree on its premises here. And the whole of Constantia has gardeners, and they use the most fantastic stuff to keep the gardens going, and not one single thing is a fruit or a vegetable. Can we stop that, please?
Leading into what kind of chemical inputs are going on, what kind of mentoring programs going on, and what the workability of that is to actually kind of roll it up into a specific entity that then can actually grow for collectively possibilities. And then just adding to urban farming is in the city of San Francisco in America, there's over 98 urban farms actually in the city where there's a lot of barter and trading going on. In Manhattan right now, there's renegade buckies that go around and people find curves and plant food. So I mean, there's also that whole extreme alternative stuff going on. But obviously here, we're not there in that perspective. But it's just really interesting of what's self-forming as the entity. And also, are these people feeling the effects of climate instability? Is it starting to hit them yet?
Just to add on to the question that I asked in the last round about the total food needs and how much urban farming produces, I think it's important for us if we're not only looking at Philippi but using a case study to understand cities and the role of urban food systems and what the current sort of situation is around how much food is needed and how much care could be supplied but is being supplied.
Yep. No, you're absolutely right about fruit trees. There were some interesting ideas around redevelopment of not Philippi horticultural area, but Philippi township, and there was an expressed interest in putting in fruit trees as a way of stabilising the soil and also as a way of providing a basic food input. Unfortunately, that project never got going. But it does seem as if we sort of missed the boat on.
May I add to that the avocado is a very good and rich fruit, and it hangs on the tree and it never goes rotten. My avocados that I grow here in Rondebosch, they've stood on that tree for a year, and the new flowers, and the new flowers were already on the tree, and I reap those old ones that have been hanging there for a year, and they were fresh, there was nothing wrong with them. You don't need refrigeration, you don't need anything, you just leave them there till you want them, then you pick them and wrap them in paper, and after 3 days.
Unfortunately, we have squirrels, and they. So it would be lovely to see more of that, and I think that there are people trying to get that going. Informal cooperative farming. Yes, Kiam's farm, before he got this farm, was part of a farming cooperative, and he found that not everyone had equal buy-in. And so that was an ongoing challenge with their cooperative. I'm not saying it's a model that doesn't necessarily work elsewhere, but they found that to be a struggle. What the Philippi folk have done is they've established a Scott Crawl Developing Farmers Association. But again, they've struggled to find a consistent mandate that they can all agree to. And so there have been that. I think that the idea of guerrilla farming is a fabulous idea. And again, it takes farming beyond being simply about the production of food, but also around the values that we have in our city. And I think that there's certainly a need for that. And one of the challenges that I found in the work that we've done is there's an awful lot of energy around urban food production in the global north. So US, Europe, and it's around these rich cultural values. It's around reclaiming sort of unestablished places, so refarming Detroit, claiming places that have become ugly, that have become dangerous. It's about recognizing ecological value. It's around building community and all of those things. And yet in the South African context and the African context, people are advocating for urban agriculture as being this development solution to a problem. And that's two very different takes on the issue. And I think we need to pull those things together, because if the story of Ali is anything to go by, people are recognizing those deep values, and we need to find a way of integrating those into these more pressing urgent development problems. And then finally, the total food needs question. Sorry, I didn't answer it first time round. It wasn't entirely a dodge, I did forget to answer it, but actually we don't have the figures. Well, colleagues in Johannesburg who've been trying to get from the city, from province, something about how much food comes into the city each year, and nobody holds records. And there's something around this absolute absence of thinking about food. There's just an assumption that it's there, and it hasn't been tracked. And so that's probably one of the things we need to move forward on. So these estimates of 40 to 50% of certain core vegetables we can do, but in terms of total food needs, it's a bit of a vacuum. So ask me in 5 years' time, maybe we'll have a good answer.
I think we should take, just after 25 past, is that right? Is it 25 past or thereabouts?
Yeah. We've got four minutes.
We'll take two questions. Who's got the highest hand? The man over there has a high hand. And right at the back.
This isn't actually about Philippi, but one of the odd developments at the market in Epping is that there's a big counter market outside, which started off with one stall. I can remember how long ago, but 15, 20 years back, there was one stall. Now there's a whole area which they're having to worry about. Why doesn't that happen somewhere else? Does it have to be next to the market?
Fish or land produce meat, because I think it's a source of protein in our diet.
Yeah, the Epping Market question is an interesting one. I think it's now called the People's Market. Well, it's beyond the People's Market. It's outside of the boundary, correct? Yeah. We did find some farmers were actually circumventing the market proper and selling there, because they weren't having to pay the, what are they called, the levies. Yeah. And so there's an element of that. The other reason that market's there is because there are agents who operate within the market who sell to that, and then it's a more direct connection to the consumer. So it is there for a reason. It's not necessarily what the people at Epping want, but it seems to be what some of the consumers want and what some of the farmers want. I'm not sure what the city's take on what should be done is. Watch this space again. And meat and protein supply, we haven't really looked at. There's a guy who works for the city who was looking at the carbon miles associated with the protein chain. I think, Gareth, you could speak to some of that tomorrow. Yeah, so it's certainly a key element, and a considerable amount of the ecological footprint of our food system is related to the protein chain.
Are these issues being undertaken for discussion, blueprints being put forward, coordination with the university and the city and the food and the government, and anything happening?
Have you watched a chameleon walking?
Thank you, Jane, very much. Please a round of applause for Jane. Before we break, I thought I'd ask Gareth just to develop some links between what you've heard today and what he'll be speaking about tomorrow.
Facebook. So what?
Just Gareth.
So what I'd like to do tomorrow is use this introduction into food and how we see food and understand food to try and look a little bit deeply into the sustainability question of cities. But expressly not taking a distinctly green approach to that and trying to look at it in terms of a set of converging crises that include climate change, inequality, and a number of other issues which I would term, and I'll try to introduce as to how they link to sustainability and particularly food, and then argue how food allows us to try and unpack that and offers clues as to where possible solutions might lie. And a bit, as Jane did here, to try and give it some richness and grounded in that, we'd look at a number of case studies where these issues are emerging and how we might respond to those issues.
Thanks, Gareth. Enjoy your evening food. Don't forget to look at the labels and give some thought to what you're popping in your mouth.